This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Vermont author Ben Hewitt is best known for his two earlier books on food, but his latest is different. It's the story of one man being deeply inspired by another. It's about Hewitt, a 40-something relatively successful writer with a wife, two kids, and his friend Eric Gillard, whom Hewitt calls both the poorest and richest man he knows. When the two first met 5 years ago, Gillard was in the midst of building his own home, or more accurately, his own shack. Hewitt describes it as like a shed for small farm animals, with no running water, no heat, and an outdoor bucket for a toilet. And yet, Hewitt says, Eric Gillard was the happiest, most contented individual he'd ever encountered. Living so frugally meant Eric wasn't beholden to bosses or banks. For the most part, he called the shots in his life, often not even knowing what time it was. Hewitt writes that his friend's fundamental happiness got him thinking hard about the role money was playing in his own life. While thrifty by most standards, Hewitt says he realized that pursuit of the almighty dollar was still exerting too much influence upon him. And while he didn't move his wife and kids into a shack like Eric's, he did ease up on the financial fretting, downscaled his life, and in doing so, discovered the profound satisfaction of living on less. Today in The Exchange, author Ben Hewitt on his latest book, Saved: How I Learned to Stop Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Let's hear from you this hour. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. And Ben Hewitt joins us from his farm in northern Vermont. And Ben, welcome back. Great to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Well, and Ben, most people who read this book aren't going to live like Eric does. You yourself admit in the book it'd be a stretch for you and your family to live in a shack. But what do you hope that readers get out of this, even if they're not going to live, you know, in a small shed with a bucket for a bathroom?
Yeah, you know, it's a great point, and because, of course, not very many people are inclined to even want to consider living like Eric does, you know, including myself, frankly. You know, I guess, you know, the book is in some ways a really complex and nuanced sort of study of this person's life and his relationship to money. But I think, you know, if I had to boil it down into sort of one sort of you know, life lesson statement, I guess I would hope that people come out of it you know, with a sort of greater awareness that the way they spend their time is the way they spend their lives.
Give us a little bit more on that, Ben. I know you talk
about
that a lot.
Well, I think that, you know, and I know that this is true of myself at times, and it's just this sort of, I think, failure to really appreciate that, you know, the sort of accumulating minutes and hours and days of our lives are, in fact, our lives. And I think, you know, one of the things that I was so drawn to with Eric was the fact that he had, you know, sort of more control. There's actually a term for it. It's called temporal autonomy, which basically means that he, you know, had autonomy over autonomy over how he spends his days more than almost, and his time more than anyone that I've met. And, you know, to a large extent, this is because he's structured his life in ways that do not compel him to spend his days, you know, earning money.
So spending time, as most of us do, in pursuit of money and our salaries means our time, and by extension, Ben, our lives are not our own. And Eric doesn't have that problem.
That's exactly right. And you know, of course, he is still beholden to money. I mean, he still needs to make a certain amount of money. He's not, you know, I don't want to give anyone the impression that, you know, he's living in this sort of utopian moneyless community. That's not the way it is at all. But you know, he is clearly again, you know, he's and this is another aspect that I really wanted to sort of study in the book, was, you know, sort of the mechanics of his life, which is like, how does he make this work? And so, if you're going to be living on less than $10,000 a year, which he does, you know, what are the mechanics of that? How does that work?
Well, and a couple caveats there in terms of the mechanics. I mean, he's held up as an ideal, but let's remember, Ben, he's young. He's in his 20s.
That's correct.
He doesn't have any health problems, which, boy, can bring you down financially and otherwise. He doesn't have children, so he's not buying sneakers every other week, you know.
That's
so
right.
How fair is it to use Eric as an ideal for the rest of us?
I would push back a little bit on the idea that he's an ideal. I think his life is full of ideas that the rest of us can incorporate into our own. On the subject of his health, he is young, so that's a great advantage right there. He's 28 years old, 29 now actually. But on the subject of his health, I mean, I think it's not hard to sort of see how a lot of, the health issues that we suffer in 21st American society are actually a product of, sort of sedentary lifestyles that are often themselves the product of us being beholden to, 50, 60 hour a week desk jobs and all of the other complications that go along with that, having to eat fast food on the way to work because we're rushing out the door to get there, or, coming home and being too tired and having to put a frozen pizza in the oven or whatever it is, that's not how Eric has structured his life. So I have no doubt that some of his good health, of course, is due to him being just young. But some of it is also due to the fact that, he hasn't had to compromise his health by being part of this sort of, frantic economy that has captured so many of us. So
there's a link there, again, between that frantic economy, that pursuit of money and health.
And there's so many links. I mean, that's one of the reasons this became for me such a sort of, I hadn't originally intended this to be as personal a book as it became. I had originally intended it for it to be basically a character study of Eric. But the more time I began spending with him and looking into these issues and thinking about these issues, the more I just began to see all of these connections in my own lives. And you described it in your intro perfectly, which is that, my family and I'm a writer, right? I guess some people would say I'm a successful writer, but, a successful writer only gets you so far. We had already structured our lives in ways to sort of accommodate that particular sort of income stream. We were already living a very frugal lifestyle by most. And yet, as you pointed out, I really began to notice as the more time I spent with Eric, how much of my sort of emotional and intellectual energy was really devoted to money. And I began to realize that if it's this way for me, it must be this way for most people. And that was another sort of aspect that I really became fascinated by, was that, money is this really, really powerful force that defines our lives. And I think that's true whether you have money or whether you don't. If you have money, you're probably thinking a lot about, how to protect it or how to invest it, how to manage it. If you don't have money, you're thinking about how to get it. I suspect most people would rather be in the former category than the latter. But the point is, it's a really, really defining force. It often defines where we live. It generally defines how we spend the majority of our waking hours. And so I really felt like I wanted to, given what a defining force it is, I wanted to just sort of better understand it, both in the sense of like, as that force and also the mechanics of it.
All right. Lots to talk about. And the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in The Exchange, author Ben Hewitt is back. His new book is officially out tomorrow. It's called Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. What do you think about some of the themes that Ben Hewitt is raising about downshifting, about living with less? And could you, would you, live on $10,000 a year like Ben Hewitt's friend Eric. Join us 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Another question about you and Eric, and then we'll definitely dive deeper into some of these themes that you raised. But just to get it out of the way, Ben, you know, you guys live in rural Vermont. You're able to grow a lot of your own food and so forth. Can urban people live this very frugal lifestyle that you recommend, or this at least scaled back lifestyle that you recommend, where we're less focused on money? Is this for people in cities and suburbs too, or just for, you know, you folks who live in Vermont?
Right. I think it's a great question. I actually get this question a lot.
I bet.
You know, I have to say that, you know, pretty much my whole life experience is sort of rooted in the rural. You know, I'm a creature of rural Vermont. And so that's certainly where I consider what I consider to be sort of my realm of expertise, you know. But, you know, in a sense, this book isn't really about money, in the sense that it's not so much about a rejection of money, but a sort of embrace of so many of these other sort of aspects of what I sort of call holistic wealth. And I think that those are true of, you know, almost any environment in which we live. You know, sort of pragmatically speaking, you know, does it take conceivably more money to live in an urban environment than a rural environment? I suspect in some cases that's true, although I do think that in some ways there may be some advantages to living in an urban environment or a more urban environment. You know, a lot of this book is sort of about what I call the currency of community, you know, this idea that instead of, you know, relying on money and all the sort of, you know, systems and the money economy to sort of support and supply your needs, you're much more reliant on the people and interdependent with the people around you. And so obviously, if you live in an area, in an environment where there's more people around you and you have more of those relationships, I think in some ways you're advantaged.
Yeah, you can't trade eggs for, you know, someone helping you with your wood stove, but maybe you can work something else out.
That's exactly right. And there are other opportunities that are unique to that system that situation or that arrangement.
All right. Yes. We will start taking your calls after a short break, and we'll talk a lot more with author Ben Hewitt. Again, the book is Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. Foodstuffs is a new series from NHPR where we're exploring the state's farms and restaurants, meeting the people who are putting new flavors on our plates and bringing new ideas to our food system. Don't miss Foodstuffs every week on All Things Considered, and check out our regular blog post on nhpr.org. More with author Ben Hewitt on The Exchange and at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show, What's Private in the Modern Age. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Mill & Travel American Express and their nearly 100 local travel professionals providing business travel service and travel management to New Hampshire businesses since 1975. And from Seacoast Orthopedics and Sports Medicine, orthopedics and team physicians for the UNH Wildcats providing repair for ACL and rotator cuff tears for UNH athletes. SOSmed.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Vermont writer Ben Hewitt is with us. His latest book is called Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. It's about living on less, letting go of consumerism, and the story of a good friend who thrives on $10,000 a year. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Ben, people already up who want to talk with you, so let's go to our listeners. Steve is first in Nottingham. Hi, Steve, you're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning. Just several comments. First of all, I believe that he has a very naive, limited view of people at work. I think of Joseph Campbell and the notion of people following their bliss. I know many people that work, they don't work for money, but they work for what they do because they love it. I know some surgeons, for example, that love to do surgery so much that when they're on vacation, they get out to South America for people that can't afford surgery and operate on them.
Wow.
So the the idea of people just being motivated by money is extremely limited and wrong.
Don't dismiss people's work, then, as just in pursuit of money. You said you had a couple points, Steve. Is that pretty much your main one?
Well, the other point is that the idea of living frugally is important for all of us, and that's one of many of your themes of your program. We're all trying to drive less, buy locally. That's no big deal.
Sure. Okay, Steve, thanks a lot. And let's take his first point, Ben. He's right. Some people follow their bliss, follow their passion. They're not working in pursuit of the almighty dollar. They're working because they love it and they think they're making a difference.
Yeah, I totally agree with him. I think it's a great point. One of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, if you... just having that awareness, you know, if this is how you want to spend your time, if you feel like this is rewarding to you, and your work is rewarding to you and accumulating money, which not everyone necessarily does. Some people are working just to get by. But if this is what is rewarding to you, then I think you should do that. But just having that sort of awareness around, you know, the recognition that this is, of course, how your life is passing, how you're spending your life. I do think it's worth pointing out that, the latest sort of studies or statistics tell us that the majority of Americans are dissatisfied with their jobs. So while I think it's true, and, you know, I love my work, and certainly the work that Eric does, he loves very much.
He works at a bicycle shop, right? Is that correct?
No, Eric works at a children's wilderness skills camp.
Got it, sure.
And he really, really, really loves his work. And I feel, you know, this incredible sense of gratitude, for being able to get up every morning and go to my desk and actually write for a living. So what Steve's saying actually really resonates with me. I think it's wonderful when people can find, a job that both fulfills that sense of bliss and also provides the income that they need, to procure the essentials of modern day life.
And Steve, I love the story of the surgeons. Yeah, go ahead.
People. It's not most people. Most people are dissatisfied with their jobs.
Okay,
that's
so
reality.
What do you do? I mean, you're not a life coach, you're an author, but what do you do then? Or what do you suggest, Ben, if you don't love it, if you're not the surgeon that Steve mentions, you know, who does surgery because people, even for people who can't afford it. But, you know, you don't love it. You kind of wake up and do it.
Yeah.
You got a mortgage. You got
a kid or two
or three or four. You are, maybe you have a health issue, so you need to take medications or see a doctor. Saving for retirement. We're all told that Social Security is not going to cover it. So what do you do? Do you just walk in and quit and forget it?
You know, obviously there are, I mean, and this is one of the most challenging issues when we start talking about money and the role that it plays in our lives, because, the way our economy is structured, you're hitting the nail on the head. You've got a mortgage, you have health issues, and you're beholden to that job for your health insurance. I talk about in the book where, you know, it's like, We've become sort of so reliant on these structures that we're both sort of depending upon them and we're sort of curating them, by having to sort of be active participants in them. So, what do you do? And no, I'm not sort of suggesting that you go and quit your job I don't know what, build yourself an 8x12 cabin like Eric did. I guess I am suggesting that, anyone who does feel that sort of sense of frustration, which I think a lot of people do feel, is to look, really closely at the particulars of your life and, look for ways that you can maybe shift things in a more positive direction. There is very little in the contemporary economy that encourages us to sort of be discerning about how we spend our time, or I'm sorry, how we spend our money. And so while I think a lot of the things we spend our money on are essentials, and I do think one of the most sort of tragic realities of, modern America is that a lot of people are forced to go into debt simply to procure the essentials, never mind the things that might be just nice to have. But I do think that we are not encouraged to be discerning and to maybe prioritize in a way that would give us a little bit more freedom, to sort of follow that bliss.
All right. Well, Steve, good to hear from you. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And let's go to Stan next, waiting in Plymouth. Hi, Stan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I live in a two-room camp in Plymouth on under $10,000 a year. I'm disabled. I've never been able to find out yet exactly how much money I'm allowed to make and maintain my disability. But occasionally I take down a tree and provide my own firewood, that sort of thing. I'm kind of the other side of the coin. I'm not in my glory living at this level.
Mm. Do you get disability checks from the government, Stan, that help
yes,
you
stay afloat?
Yes, I do,
once a month.
Yeah.
It lasts about 3 days, and I spend 27 days a month in poverty.
Wow. Yeah, so you're not in your glory days, as you said, living in that two-room camp.
Right.
So do you feel that Ben is perhaps putting too happy a glow on poverty?
No, I just, I have to appreciate he probably started at a more qualified level. I'm not particularly educated. I see my opportunity out of poverty by biting off my writer's block and doing something about it.
Stan, great to hear from you, and thank you very much. And, you know, I had a similar thought reading the book. You know, it's fine to say, oh, isn't it great? He lives simply. But, you know, poverty is not always pretty.
Yeah, I really, really appreciate that call. So, you know, thanks so much, Stan, for calling in and for your comments. And, whoa, you know, I think, and this is something that Eric talks about in the book and something that I've really sort of come to understand. So I think, you know, at this point, it would be appropriate for me to talk a little bit about, you know, my sort of personal economy as it relates to money, just so people know where I'm coming from. You know, educationally speaking, it's interesting that Stan brought up education. I'm actually a high school dropout myself. I did not finish high school. I did do a couple of semesters at a state level college, but it just wasn't for me. And you know, I support my family on an income of about a family of four of about $30,000 after taxes. And of course, my income fluctuates because I'm self-employed and I don't, you know, from year to year. But that's been about the average over the past few years. So I come at this, you know, from this place of, I guess, not necessarily being particularly privileged in the financial sense, and not being particularly privileged in the sort of, regarding our contemporary expectations for education sense. And yet I do feel, and I think this is a really, really important thing to talk about, that I have, you know, simply the fact that I'm, you know, was able to write this book and I can have all these sort of highfalutin conversations about money and wealth and can be here on the radio with you, you know, is indicative of my own privilege. There's no question about that. So in a sense, I'm really, really privileged. And Eric talks about this a lot. You know, he doesn't, and I've heard, you know, you use that word frugal a few times or that word being used. You know, Eric does not really think of himself as frugal. And he doesn't even really think of himself. He certainly doesn't think of himself as being poor. You know, I think he thinks of himself as being actually incredibly privileged to be able to live this way and to have this particular view of the world. And I'm not saying, you know, that's necessarily an answer for Stan. I'm just sort of trying to, you know, provide a little context for Eric's view into these issues and also my view into these issues. But, you know, Stan's exactly right. I mean, you know, there are a lot of people for whom, you know, poverty is no joy. They're not necessarily seeing the sort of, you know, the great sort of spiritual wonder in all of this. They're simply sort of struggling to get by day to day. And I think, you know, what that speaks to is the tremendous challenges we have in our sort of underlying economic arrangements that make it really, really difficult, you know, for people to get out of those situations. And we could talk for, you know, probably a month's worth of shows about why, you know, it has evolved in that way.
Yeah, but, there's a danger in prettifying poverty. And,
I agree. That's right.
So how do you balance that, Ben, as you talk to people about, look, maybe you don't need as much. Maybe you could live with less. Maybe you don't need the new TV, and then there'd be less pressure on you to make money at work. But you don't want to prettify poverty.
And deprivation and all of those things. But by the same token, I think that there's just as much a danger in, you know, sort of prettifying wealth, in a sense, you know, because I think it is, you know, the way money works and our economy works in contemporary America is that it does enable, you know, sort of vast accumulations of wealth. And it is part of that arrangement that makes it very, very difficult for people like Stan to simply meet ends meet. So I do think that as much of a danger as it is, the sort of glorifying, you know, sort of doing without, there is this sort of more widespread assumption that there's also glory in, you know, having so much more than what you need. And I think there's a lot of danger in that, too.
Let's take some more calls. And, Stan, good luck to you. Thank you very much for calling in. And Sandy's in Conway. Sandy, thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much.
Sure.
I just had an observation for your author, and I'm looking forward to reading his book. I haven't read it yet. Is that my when my daughter was young and she went to camp, you know, there were a lot of girls in the camp that came from very wealthy families, were middle income, I'm self-employed, and she developed a very difficult understanding of what money is, and she saw money as the root of a lot of problems for these very wealthy girls.
So she didn't envy them, Sandy. She didn't come back and say, I want this, this, and this.
No. They would all sit around and talk about what their problems were. And she's like, Mom, I don't have any problems. These girls have huge problems. And she associated it with money. And I knew that was not, you know, money is not always the case. And so I ended up raising her under the pretense that money is a tool. It's nothing more than a John Deere tractor. Yeah. And you have to understand how to drive that John Deere tractor, or you'll do damage.
Great. Sandy, thank you so much for calling in. What do you think, Ben? And you're a dad. You've got two sons, so
right.
You're in that mode yourself.
Yeah, and that comment that money is a tool is so spot on. And I think that one of the real problems with money, as we've come to view it, is that we no longer really see it as a tool. I mean, the way I look, and this is one of the things that's been most transformational about my relationship to money since, you know, spending the time writing this book and spending so much time with Eric, is that I now sort of view money as merely one of many means to achieve an end, right? It's one way to sort of get the things that I need to sort of survive and thrive in this world. But, you know, I think the problem is, or one of the problems is that, you know, we now view the accumulation of money as an end unto itself. So we no longer see it really as a tool, but as a goal. And I think that's really, really problematic. It's problematic for people like Stan, who are, you know, sort of, I think, suffer, and you know, millions of people like him who suffer the effects of that mentality, sort of the mentality of money, you know, in our culture. And it's actually even problematic, although, you know, most of us probably have a little less empathy for those who are accumulating it all. It's probably even problematic for the people who are accumulating it all, as I think it was Sandy was just pointing out.
Well, Sandy, thanks a lot for calling. And real quickly, Ben, as I said, you've got two boys. And I asked Sandy if her daughter came back from camp saying, you know, Mom, these girls have so much more than I do, clothes, jewelry, vacations, whatever, I want it too. Mm-hmm. She said, no. What about your boys as they get older, as they encounter other kids? Do they say, hey, you know, Joey's got the latest electronic gizmo, and I would really like that too. How much do you encounter that?
We don't encounter it a lot, and you know, part of that is because, I'll be really straight up about our arrangement here. We actually homeschool our children, and so although they do have, you know, a lot of friends that they see, you know, on a fairly regular basis, there is a certain amount of sort of, you know, income stratification, I guess. There's some stasis there. Most of the people that they associate with regularly also come from families who, you know, of similar minds and similar sort of income brackets. So there's just not a lot of that. So partly they haven't been exposed to it all that much. And I think that partly, you know, they hear us, you know, my wife and I having these conversations about money and wealth, and they see, you know, how our expectations and assumptions are being sort of set around money and wealth. And, you know, we were talking a while back about Eric and, you know, well, he doesn't have kids and, you know, he doesn't have all those associated expenses. And I think you mentioned something about, you know, new sneakers or whatever it was. And, you know, that's true. But it also does assume, you know, a certain sort of economy around children, which is to say that, you know, I can't remember the last time we bought our children a new pair of sneakers or any new article of clothing. They just don't have those expectations because we just don't do it.
So you buy stuff at thrift shops, clothing,
thrift
shoes.
Shops, yard sales, whatever it is. There's tons of stuff out there. There's no real need to buy children new clothes, you know. And you know, I'm not saying that Eric's life wouldn't be different if he had children, or that it's not more expensive to have children, because it is.
They get sick and they do need
sure,
clothes.
Sure, of course.
And
yeah.
I'm guessing that parents of daughters are saying, and they're boys, but because sometimes
right.
girls do feel the need for new clothes and boys as well. But I
but
hear
of course,
you. You're in a different social milieu, isn't it? Yeah. Go ahead.
It's a socialized need, you know, and it's a need that is sort of instilled in them by the sort of broader economy. It's not an actual need. It's a need they've been socialized to.
You don't need new clothes. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, no. No, you do not. And, myself, too. I mean, you know, it's funny that we talk about this now, because every, you know, when I have a book coming out, I go and do all these readings, right, for the book, to sort of promote the book, which I love to do. But it brings with it a certain degree of stress, because now I got to figure out what to wear. You know?
Well, you're a Vermont farmer. I mean, you know,
right.
That's
well,
easy.
Yes, but even you know, I've got two sets of clothing, Laura, both of which were sourced at thrift stores that I use for when I need to look presentable. But I have to say that they're the same two sets of clothing I've worn for the last two books that have been released, and I'm starting to wonder if people are beginning to notice that I'm always wearing the same clothes when I go do these readings. But
what?
You know, the point is that you know, and I'm not even holding that up as a model or an ideal, but I do think that we have come to sort of embody all of these assumptions about what it is that we need, and that a lot of them are actually, you know, are really quite false.
All right. Well, thanks for that call again. And the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, whether you think you need new clothes or not, 1-800-892-6477. Join us. You can email to exchange@nhpr.org. What do you make of some of the themes that Ben is talking about in his book? Downshifting, living with less. Could you, would you consider living on $10,000 a year like Ben's friend Eric? What purpose does money serve in making us comfortable and happy? We'd love your thoughts on those questions and more at 1-800-892-6477. Back in a minute.
This is NHPR, where support comes from your members and from New Hampshire Magazine and its 12th annual Best of New Hampshire Party, featuring food from more than 60 restaurants, plus music and entertainment. Details at bestofnh.com. And Hospice at HCS, providing comfort, care, and support for people with advanced illness in southwestern New Hampshire, from offices in Keene, Peterborough, and Charlestown. HCSservices.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
NHPR counts on listener support to keep you informed about important issues and events in New Hampshire, across the country, and around the world. When you make a contribution before our short June drive, you become a part of our daily broadcast. Plus, you'll be automatically entered to win our two drawing prizes, an overnight trip to Tanglewood to see Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and a five-night trip to Lisbon, Portugal. Make your gift at 1-888-805-NHPR or at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier program on the alarming rise in allergies, especially in children. Join us tomorrow morning at 9 for that conversation. Today in The Exchange, author Ben Hewitt is back with his new book called Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. Join our conversation, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Ben, right back to our callers. And Sharon's calling from Hebron. Hi, Sharon, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with my husband and I have, we make maple syrup and have a lot of fruit trees, live in large part on the land in Hebron. And we were hoping to barter with a friend giving maple syrup in return for bee rentals to pollinate our trees. And then somebody told us that we had to account for that at the end of the year in our taxes, which we found, again, brings it back to money and puts the focus even more on money, and found that that would be even harder. Just wondering what you would say to that. What do you do then?
Wow, so you have to pay taxes on the barter economy, Sharon?
That's what we were told, yes.
Wow, okay. Thanks for calling in. Ben, any experience with this? You are a farmer, and you do lots of barter?
I would suspect that there is perhaps some divergence between what you are sort of legally obligated to do and you know, what you might actually, the risk you might actually face if you were to do that without reporting that barter. But she's entirely right that, you know, barter is supposed to be reported on your taxes. And I don't, you know, I don't have a really good answer for, you know, how to circumnavigate that, if that's what she's asking, or whether she should or not. I guess that would be, I would leave that up to her to determine whether or not that, you know, the federal government should have anything to do with, you know, the barter commerce that she's talking about. What I really like about her comment, which is not really, you know, it's not answering her question, but I think it's really interesting, is, one of the things I've been talking a lot about this book recently, and a theme that keeps coming up, or a phrase that keeps coming up, is this sort of idea of, you know, the personal economy. And I think one of the things I think that's really interesting is that, you know, we've come to view, you know, the word economy as being just sort of solely about like money and finance. When in fact, you know, historically speaking, that word is much more sort of how we manage the home. That's the root of that word. You know, what she's talking about, and the way I've started to sort of look at my own life and the way money sort of fits into my own life is, and it gets a little bit back to Sandy's comment of money being a tool, is that money is just sort of a portion of my personal economy, and that my economy really, you know, incorporates so many other aspects of my life, my relationships with other people, with friends and community members, my family, my relationships, you know, to the land, to my farm, my relationship to nature, you know, my time and how I spend it. And money is one aspect of that, but you know, you see how in our society, contemporary society, you know, the word economy has come to be sort of solely about money. And we don't really have a great way of talking about all of these other things that I think are really, really important to sort of, you know, living a fulfilled life.
Yeah, we used to have classes, home economics, I remember.
Sure.
And we learned,
right,
you know, how to sew and how to make things from scratch. And that was part of our economy. It wasn't just about buying stuff.
That's right, and but how often do those exist anymore? Most of those are gone, you know. In large part, why? Because there's been, you know, financial hardship at the schools that taught them, and so they've had to do away with them.
Let's take another call, 1-800-892-6477, or an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email that just came in from Wendy in Tamworth, Ben, on the subject of health care. If Eric did have a health emergency, his care would most likely be free because of his low income. Those of us who are paying huge premiums for our own health care would essentially be paying for his care. The only way we as a society could, quote, afford to live the way that the author's proposing is to have universal health care. Wendy says, I agree with the philosophy that we as a society spend too much time in the rat race of chasing after money, but living in the simpler way that Ben espouses would be unrealistic for the majority of Americans. Wendy, great thoughts. What do you think, Ben?
Well, I both agree with her and disagree with her, I guess. And you know, the subject of healthcare, and I talk about this a lot I talk about it some in the book, particularly toward the end of the book when I'm considering, you know, our relationship to healthcare and what this means, you know, for my children. And this does sort of get back into navigating, you know, parenthood in relation to these issues. You know, here's where we get into why this is such a nuanced subject, because our healthcare system and the way our healthcare system works is entirely structured around sort of, you know, I keep sort of using this phrase, the mentality of money, but it's very much sort of, you know, a system that is dependent, it's a product of and is dependent on the way our moneyed economy works right now. And so she's right, you know, that to imagine sort of a different way would mean that we would have to have some kind of universal health care. I don't, you know, personally see an issue with that. I think, you know, the assumption that the arrangements that we have around health care, the assumption that those are the way they maybe should be, although I think that assumption is probably maybe not that widespread. I think most people recognize that we have enormous problems with our health care system and that we need to sort of transition to something else.
Do you have health insurance, Ben?
I do have health insurance. I do.
You sort of probably pay on the individual market, which is probably pretty expensive.
It's not inexpensive, you know, and we have coverage that does allow us to sort of, you know, deal with emergency situations. Most of the healthcare that we get is healthcare that we receive outside, you know, sort of the commodity, the health institutions. So, you know, we're fortunate to live in a community and in a region where there are a lot of sort of so-called alternative healthcare options.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of these providers don't even deal with insurance because they don't want to. They're sort of realizing what a boondoggle that is, and that they can offer their care much more inexpensively if they are, you know, sort of stepping outside that system.
Well, Wendy, thank you for the email, and let's take another call. And Carla is waiting in Concord. Hi, Carla, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. I'm really enjoying this subject. I just had a couple of comments I wanted to make talking about using the discount stores, the Goodwill Salvation Army. You can really find some quality goods. I buy designer clothes when I go to the stores. I love Salvation Army, rummaging around. It's my favorite place. I basically don't shop anywhere else for clothing and often get compliments on my attire. But the other comment I wanted to make, too, was I feel like the next generation coming along, talking about my own children and children of their generation in their 30s, seem to be far more concerned with living a life of quality, not quantity. I really don't see them as being a generation that needs a lot to make them happy, a lot of, you know, things. They really just seem to appreciate the things they do have and the things they do acquire, and are more inclined to invest money in experiences.
So really, you're seeing some positive developments in terms of our relationship with money, Carla, and the next generation.
I really think so. And I'm not quite sure why that is, you know, given that these children were from the, you know, baby boom generation, where it seemed that it was very important for all of us to have the most toys that we could possibly acquire. Mm-hmm. And it seems to have had an opposite effect on them from my observation.
Okay, Carla, good to hear from you. Thank you very much. And go ahead. Differences among generations. Carla's seeing what you would call some positive trends, Ben.
I actually really agree with her. I think she's spot on. And I think, you know, one thing I would really like to point out is I don't even think Eric would sort of consider himself, you know, sort of anti-materialist. I think actually, you know, he embodies a sort of an almost a sort of more positive materialism, where the things that he owns, you know, he tends to have some sort of relationship to them because there are things that people have made for him or have been gifted to him. And he has this sort of, they're imbued with this sort of relationship. And so it's almost like this, you know, it's not like anti-materialism. It's almost like a deeper sense of materialism, where he really sort of reveres the objects in his life, which are relatively few, you know, compared to what most of us have. But, you know, to her larger point about, you know, this shift, I think I actually see it myself. And I think it comes of this awareness that, you know, we have, most of us, I'm 41, you know, have grown up in this era of sort of, you know, an increased level of consumerism and this incredible abundance in stuff. And I think what happens is that the more, you know, sort of the wealthier we become in all of that stuff, it's almost as if it kind of erodes, you know, the wealth in the things that really matter. So that we become, as we become richer in one aspect, in another aspect, we're almost becoming poorer. And I think there's a real awareness of that. Never mind all of the sort of environmental implications or, you know, sociocultural implications of you know, the production and distribution of this stuff. I just think that people, and I see this a little bit, as you know, my first book was sort of about, you know, local food and food systems. And I've come to sort of, you know, in my own head, I sort of view the desire for people to connect with food as almost being a symptom of this desire to sort of have strengthened relationships with the people in their communities, with their friends and neighbors, and even, you know, with the sort of the natural world that ultimately sort of provides for us.
All right, let's take one more if we could. And Becky's in Peterborough. Hi, Becky, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, go ahead.
I love this subject. It's one of my favorite subjects.
That's great, Becky.
I wanted to make two comments. One, to go back to what Ben said about the socialization of young girls, particularly in, quote, unquote, their desire to have new clothes. This is completely arbitrary and totally a product of the system, of the capitalist system and the money. And I watch my young granddaughters who, despite their parents who try really, really hard to instill in them some values, non-material values, and buy used clothes, they get it right, left, and center from the media, from their friends, from school, from everywhere they turn. And we're not born wanting clothes. We are taught to want things. And the second thing, I guess, which is connected to that, is I've lived in countries where most of the people are quote-unquote poor, but they never consider themselves poor. They don't consider themselves, they may be money poor, but they don't consider themselves poor. They don't even use the word poverty. Mm-hmm. And so us as Americans using the word poverty is a negative term. It's something we don't want to be. So I would suggest or think of with Ben what other word he could use other than poverty, because it's all about
it's too
not
negative,
being
Becky.
Rich.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling in. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, of course, I love that call. You know, it speaks to everything that the book is sort of about. And I agree. I mean, I almost never use the word poverty. And one of the big challenges is, like, what is the language that we use around this stuff? You know, because we have these words that have certain associations. And so, you know, as I sort of say in the book, you know, when I say Eric Gillard is the poorest guy I know, it's really easy to sort of demonstrate that because I can show you, you know, the numbers of his bank account. You know, I can show you the house that he lives in. When I say he's the wealthiest guy I know, it's much more difficult to demonstrate that because his wealth is not that same sort of it doesn't present itself quite so tangibly or in terms that we in our culture have come to sort of accept as wealth. So I think her point about language is fantastic, and I find myself, you know, often using these words and then, you know, having to sort of, you know, qualify them in some way. Another point I would really, you know, and I also loved her comment, of course, about other countries and about people's sort of relationship to wealth. I mean, there are cultures on this globe today where a person's, you know, wealth and standing in their community is measured not in what they accumulate but in what they give away. And so I guess I know we're getting sort of, you know, near to the end of our conversation, but it's something I think about a lot, you know, is how would our nation look different? How would the world look different, you know, if our culture and the people in our culture wealth was measured not in what they accumulated, but in what they gave away?
Well, thanks for that comment, Becky. And here's a comment that Jim posted on the Exchange's Facebook page. Could we get an idea of what Ben's monthly expenses are like?
Oh, that's a great. Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Right, and we spend, you know, it ranges, but you know, last year, let's see, I think last year, as I said, I think we earned about $30,000 after taxes, and we managed to save about $5,000 of that. So, I guess $2,000 a month, but you know, here's where we get back to this whole idea that I am so privileged, right? Because I am. I really am. Despite that modest income, you know, my wife and I had the and I'm privileged in ways that were just, you know, we made choices almost before we even knew we were making good choices. So, and some of it was just luck. We bought our land in 1997. We had saved up enough to pay for half of it. We got the rest on a loan through the bank. But we bought 40 acres of beautiful land for $30,000, which
would
be very difficult to replicate today. So there's just, like, good timing, you know. I grew up in rural Vermont and was sort of socialized to a particular skill set that enabled us, to build our own house. Right. So we built our house with our own four hands and those of many friends. But the point I'm trying to make is, you know, we were able to build our house largely out of pocket and slowly over time so that we never had an overwhelming mortgage. We did have a construction loan. But right now, at the age of 41, I'm debt free. And so, you know, I am really I want to be really forthright about acknowledging, you know, my own tremendous privilege and some of the choices that I made even before I really realized they were choices. I mean, Penny and I, my wife and I, have always just been really debt adverse. I until I sort of wrote this book and spent all this time thinking about it, I might not have been able to articulate why we were so debt adverse, you know, but we were, and that's what matters. So we never got on to that sort of treadmill.
So you don't
and
have that big old mortgage payment that a lot of people have hanging over their heads.
And
Ben,
yes,
thank you. Go ahead.
Well, no, it's just, it is hard to sort of back off of that. You know, once you have gotten on that treadmill, I don't think it's impossible, but it does require perhaps a little more nimbleness and cleverness.
All right. And lots more to dig into. I want to let everybody know, Ben, that you'll be talking about your book at Main Street Bookends in Warner this Wednesday. So if you want more information about that, you can go to our website, nhpr.org. Ben, thank you very much for being with us. We really
appreciate
it.
I really appreciate it.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Again, that's author Ben Hewitt. The new book, Saved, How I Quit Worrying About Money and Became the Richest Guy in the World. It is officially out tomorrow. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org. NHPR's short June membership drive starts on the 12th. When we meet our goal for the day, we'll earn a $10,000 challenge grant from the Byrne Foundation. You can help keep us on track with a gift of $50 or $500 or something in between. Your donation today will count towards that first day goal, that $10,000 challenge, and it will help us bring you more of the programs you rely on. Make your gift now at nhpr.org. And thanks.
The Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 on